From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Murray Pariah, one of the great classical pianists of our time, about playing and not playing. For several years during the 90s, a hand injury kept him away from the piano. He's since recovered and has just released the complete Etudes of Frédéric Chopin. Also, there's a new 50th anniversary DVD edition of Singing in the Rain. We'll talk with film director and choreographer Stanley Donen. He and Gene Kelly co-directed and co-choreographed the film. Donen also directed On the Town, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, Funny Girl, and more. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Igby Goes Down. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy today made an impassioned speech against hasty action toward Iraq. The Democrats' remarks come as the Bush administration is working with Congress to craft a resolution allowing the use of force against Baghdad. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
Senator Kennedy said there's little doubt that Saddam Hussein, with his weapons of mass destruction, poses a threat to the world.
But the administration has not made a convincing case that we face such an imminent threat to our national security that a unilateral, preemptive American strike and an immediate war are necessary.
Kennedy said a war against Iraq would jeopardize the lives of many American soldiers, drain resources from the war against terrorism, and raise the possibility of a broader conflict in the Middle East. He said the United States should first pursue efforts to disarm Saddam through the United Nations. President Bush said he's willing to give that a try, but also wants the flexibility to take action on his own if the UN efforts fail. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
The police outnumbered protesters in the nation's capital today. Demonstrators gathered to protest a meeting of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So far, about 600 people have been arrested. Ben Gilbert reports.
Police in full riot gear literally threw demonstrators to the ground at one point after two illegal protests joined near the White House. Police pushed the protesters into a park and surrounded them. The scene was peaceful until police began arresting the demonstrators, restraining them with plastic handcuffs. Washington Police Chief Charles Ramsey said the D.C. police are trying to prevent illegal activity.
We're operating on a premise that, you know, the intent today is try to shut down Washington. That's been all over websites, trying to break windows and things of that nature. When they take the streets and refuse to get out, we can only assume that they're trying to go through with the threats. So we take it very seriously.
Those arrested today at the park will be charged with failure to obey a police order. For NPR News, I'm Ben Gilbert in Washington.
The Bush administration today announced a decision to begin classifying developing fetuses as unborn children. Officials say that way low-income pregnant women can get prenatal care. However, critics say the move is actually a back doorway to undercut abortion rights. The Ford Motor Company agreed today to pay to modify thousands of police cars. They made the concession after police departments across the country complained that the car's gas tanks were prone to causing fires and certain crashes. At least a dozen officers have been killed in such crashes. Under the plan, Ford will install shields around the gas tanks of some 350,000 Crown Victoria police cars. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 296 points, or 3.7% today, to finish the week at 7701. The Nasdaq closed down 22 points, or nearly 2%, finishing up at 1199. This is NPR News. Isidore has been downgraded from a tropical storm to a depression, but that hasn't stopped it from dumping rain on the midwestern portion of the country. Isidore moved into Ohio today and has dropped up to 2 inches of rain on the southwestern part of that state. In Tennessee, a man was killed when his car was swept away by floodwaters, and in Mississippi, two deaths are being blamed on that weather system. The man at the center of a battle between a Philadelphia court and the anarchist group MOVE was found shot to death this morning. The radical group gained notoriety in 1985 when police bombed the group's house. 11 people were killed and dozens of nearby homes were destroyed. From member station WHYY in Philadelphia, Arias Keck reports.
Weeks ago, MOVE boarded up the windows of their two houses in West Philadelphia. The group said it was preparing to defy a judge's decision for unsupervised visits between the 6-year-old child of a MOVE member and her ex-husband, John Gilbride. Early Friday morning, Gilbride was found shot to death outside his New Jersey apartment. Prosecutor Robert Bernardi says he plans to contact MOVE members.
They either agree to talk to us or they agree not to talk to us. That's their decision.
MOVE leader Ramona Africa says they had nothing to do with Gilbride's death.
And the only people that we know that are treacherous and cold like that is the government.
Africa was one of two survivors of the 1985 clash with police. For NPR News, I'm Aris Keck in Philadelphia.
A Nebraska judge has denied bond for four men being held in connection with one of the nation's deadliest bank robberies. Five people were killed yesterday when robbers ran into a Nebraska bank and shot everyone in the head. All four are being charged with five counts of first-degree murder. If convicted, they could all face the death penalty. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Freddie Mac Foundation, working to strengthen families and help youth achieve their potential through funding of nonprofit organizations. FreddieMacFoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Murray Pariah is one of the great pianists of our time. In the London Times, he was described as one of the piano's most lyrical contemporary poets. His career was launched in 1972 after winning the Leeds International Piano Competition. He's since performed with leading orchestras around the world and has made many acclaimed recordings. But for about 3 years, he was unable to play because of a hand injury. During this frustrating hiatus, he studied the music of Bach. His recent recordings include Bach's Goldberg Variations and keyboard concertos. He has a new recording of Chopin Etudes. Terry spoke with him last year. Before we hear their conversation, let's listen to his new recording of Chopin. From Opus 25, this is Etude No. 2 in F minor.
What are you thinking, if anything, when you're performing and you're deep into a piece? Are you...
I'm always involved in the line. It's very hard to explain what the line is of a piece, especially to a non-musician. But it's the sort of thing that keeps the thing up. You know, we, as musicians, have to fight gravity. Gravity is down. And we have to keep the thing flowing and the thing up. And I'm always involved in that aspect of things, whether it be through rhythm or whether it be through dynamic inflection or whether it be through sense of direction going towards a certain place and then coming away from a certain place, anything to keep it from being grounded.
Now, forgive a real amateur's question about this. When you're thinking about rhythm, are you ever, ever counting?
Occasionally, but more, it's more abstract. It's more, I will think, for instance, about long phrases and that involves rhythm. In other words, four bars are in one breath, let's say. And it's an instinctive thing that's almost a part of the body. It's not something that you're consciously aware of once you've decided it.
No, you talk about breath, but you're playing with your hands. It's not a wind instrument. Do you still think in terms of breath?
Very much.
You're breathing.
Very much, because I'm singing, even if I'm not opening my voice. I'm singing through the piano, and this is involves breath and involves even breath control, all kinds of things that are sort of imaginary, but they're very important.
Did you have to learn how to keep breathing in a relaxed way while you're performing?
I think about relaxation occasionally, most often not when I'm performing, but when I'm practicing, and to try to be aware of when I'm tensing too much so that the music is actually being compressed and not being allowed its full throttle. But somehow in the performances, it's not something uppermost in my mind.
What is uppermost in your mind? The line that you were talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. You've been recording a lot of Bach lately. Do you understand your affinity with his music?
Understand it completely, I don't. But I think that Bach is the essence of music. That Bach, through his logic and through his comprehensiveness, made every note follow the next so inevitably and at the same time with so much surprise that he influenced the rest of music. Nobody could compose really the same way once they had been exposed to Bach's music.
You recently recorded the Goldberg Variations. For listeners who don't know the story of how Bach created it, could you give us the short version of that story?
Bach was commissioned by a count, Count Kaiserling, to write a piece for him that would while away the hours that he couldn't sleep at night. And this would be played to him by one of Bach's proteges, namely Goldberg. One thing we do know was that Goldberg was an incredible harpsichordist, and he was very young. He was about 14 years old when he would have been playing this. He died at the age of 21 and was known for being able to sight read anything and play everything with a nimbleness and a fleetness and also an understanding that belied his years. So I think there's a lot of credibility to the story, because I think that rather than provide a sleeping pill, as some people would have said this music was, which it certainly isn't, there's nothing sleep-inducing about the Goldberg Variations, I think it would give him comfort, spiritual comfort, solace during, let's say, a troubled night. And because the music speaks of joy, of radiance, and certainly towards the end of some kind of spiritual salvation, if you want.
Can you choose one of the variations and discuss what's going on technically and emotionally?
If I would choose one variation, it would probably be the 25th, which is in the minor, and it's the longest variation, and in a way it's the most harrowing variation because it has all these chromatic notes, and it talks a language that up to that point in the piece, Bach didn't talk. Up to that point, one was amazed or awed by the wizardry of the canons and all of the incredible virtuosity. But suddenly at this point, the music becomes much, much slower. And what I feel happens is a depiction of the crucifixion, something very, very disturbing and completely disturbing the whole equilibrium of the piece. I think it takes the next few variations to overcome this disturbance.
Well, why don't we hear that 25th variation in Bach's Goldberg Variations performed by Murray Pariah.
Thank you.
That's Murray Pariah from his recent recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations. There was a period of about 5 years when you had to stop performing. You had an infection in your thumb that developed into a bone spur. Why was this so difficult to treat?
Good question. I don't know. Part of the reason was that instead of taking care of the infection, I just took 2 days of the antibiotics, and then since I was fine, stopped taking them. And I think that that was a no-no.
So I'm wondering what it was like for you to go through a period of several years without being able to play, since so much of your life revolves around performance.
It's not even performance, you know.
Right, exactly, just playing in general.
Just
yeah.
playing in general, because playing for me is, in a way, more fulfilling than speaking. It's an aspect of expressing myself. And it was, in a way, to have your tongue or something cut off and not be able to speak, really, to speak the way you wanted to speak.
So were there other ways that you had to relate to music when you couldn't play? Was listening satisfying?
Well, that's what I did. I listened, and I listened even away from, let's say, the record player. I just listened in my mind to the scores. I needed a lot of Bach. I don't know particularly why. I think probably the spiritual solace we were talking about was very important to me. And so I listened to a lot of Bach, and I studied a lot of scores.
What did you get from having this hiatus in which you had the time to just study scores?
In a way, with hindsight, I would say it was a great blessing, because I was able also to study analysis, to study counterpoint and harmony, all of these things that if I was practicing, I wouldn't do. And you get a perspective of what music is about that is more important than actually playing the instrument. You get to the essence of what music is about.
Could you maybe describe a little more what you mean about that?
Well, the laws of harmony and the laws of counterpoint are, for me, essential laws in order to understand what shapes music. Why is this note there? Why not another note? It's not only a composer's whim that puts it there. They have to subscribe to a lot of laws of tonality, in other words, of dissonant treatment, how you use a dissonant and when you introduce it and how you resolve it, all these questions that are about the tensions that are in music. Now, a chance to study this without technical preoccupations, without worrying about your fourth finger or your fifth finger or whatever, it's a very important opportunity because it gets you into the composer's shoes. And so in a way, I was very grateful to have that time off.
When you started playing again, what music did you start with and why did you choose that?
I started with Mozart because somehow I was most familiar with the Mozart and I thought that would put less pressure on me. And so when I had concerts to come back to, as in February, I think, were my first concerts, I was supposed to play the Beethoven Emperor Concerto. Instead, I played some of the Mozart concertos.
Did your fingers remember what to do? And I'm wondering, what won out when you started playing again, the joy of being able to play again or the frustration of being rusty?
No, actually, for some reason, I think probably because I started very young playing the piano, the rustiness didn't last very long. And within a week or 2 weeks, quite amazingly, I was able to regain the facility. It's when you start lessons very young, you get a certain amount of facility that stays with you your whole life. And therefore, I was lucky in that way. So it wasn't the rustiness, but it was the great joy of playing again and not taking something for granted that one took for granted one's whole life. You always thought you could play, and suddenly you saw that you couldn't. And then when it came back, you were so grateful that it was just mind-blowing.
Murray Pariah speaking with Terry Gross last spring. He has a new CD of Chopin Etudes. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to our interview with pianist Murray Pariah. He has a new CD of Chopin Etudes.
You started playing piano, I believe, at the age of 4.
That's right.
Was it your idea or your parents' idea?
No, it was always my idea. My parents, I think, gratefully, did not know too much about music, though my father wanted me to pursue music. He didn't know enough about it to really be a hindrance in that pursuit. What he did was he took me to the opera when I was very young, 4 years old. And I loved it so much that I came back singing some of the arias from it. And so therefore, he thought I should get a piano and work with a neighborhood teacher. And she soon had me graduated to a bigger piano. And I loved to improvise. I didn't like to practice so much. In fact, I don't think I started seriously practicing till I was around 15. But I would be improvising and sort of making arrangements of tunes that I had heard at the opera, let's say. Or other things, Spanish tunes. My father loved Spanish music, and so therefore I would arrange Spanish music for him. That was the bulk of my musical activities at first. And then I started seriously with a teacher, Jeanette Hain, was my principal teacher from around the age of 6 till 17.
Were you considered a prodigy, and did you have the pressures on you that so many prodigies have?
Well, I think I was considered a prodigy, but my teacher made sure that I didn't give concerts so that I didn't have those pressures, and I didn't give a real concert till I was 17.
One of your mentors was Vladimir Horowitz. How did you meet him?
I met him very early in my life, at the age of about 18 or 17, when I was in Marlborough, and Mr. Serkin told me that Mr. Horowitz wanted to teach somebody, and he thought that I should work with him. And so I played to Mr. Horowitz at that age, and he did want to work with me. But as I told him much later, and as he himself surmised, I was too frightened, actually, to study with him. So I didn't study with him at that age. But he watched me all along, kept an eye on me. I went over his house occasionally. And then, much later in my life, towards the last 4 years of his life, actually, I think I was already 40, then I went to him for some coaching, I guess, or talking about music. And it was more informal than actual lessons. But I did play to him quite a bit, and I had the enormous privilege of having him play for me and hearing him play.
What were you afraid of when you were a teenager and he offered to work with you?
I don't completely know. I think such a big personality at 18... is a bit daunting. And there was another aspect to me at 18. I wanted to find my own way. I wanted to know what was important for me musically. I just felt the need to see what I needed. And I thought a personality like Horowitz would be too difficult for me to deal with.
Because you'd have to follow his way and not be able to listen to your own?
Yes, or I would be too daunted by it and feel too small in comparison to it. Or, I don't know. It was an instinctual reaction rather than a thought-out reaction.
No, I've read that he gave you the advice, if you want to be more than a virtuoso, first you have to be a virtuoso. What did he mean by that?
He saw that I hadn't played any of the virtuoso repertoire for the piano, the Liszt, the Rachmaninoff, Scriabin, all the difficult virtuoso pieces, that I had mainly done the classical repertoire, Mozart, Beethoven, Haydn. And he said, if you want to be a poet or a philosopher and play that music, that's fine. But in order, as he said, to be more than a virtuoso, first you had to conquer all the difficulties of being a virtuoso, which is the possibilities of the piano and mastering them, the sounds that a piano could give you. And he was absolutely right.
Why had you avoided until then the more romantic composers?
I wouldn't say romantic, because I had played Schumann and Chopin, but I would say virtuosic.
Mm-hmm.
Partly it was a prejudice that I had, that the music wasn't worthy, and it's a false prejudice.
But that it was really flashy, showy?
Yeah, and that's, in a way, a false prejudice, because Horowitz is right. Until you can make that music sound convincing, then you don't have the resources to approach the great music.
So when you started playing Rachmaninoff, Scriabin, how did you approach it? I mean, because if you were turned off by the more of kind of flashy showman aspects of it, did you
I was able to take a different route? Yeah. See, through Horowitz's coaching and through his inspiration, I was able to see the excitement of color, of the emotionalism of that music on its own level. And I could see that you couldn't just go through the motions of playing, let's say, octaves or difficult bits correctly, that wouldn't have been enough, that this music had a spark of something that you had to bring to life, and I was able to see it through his eyes.
Why don't we listen to a 1990 recording of yours of Rachmaninoff's Etude No. 5 in E-flat minor. Do you want to say anything about this?
No, this was one of the pieces that I worked on with Horowitz, and I must say that in that period, and probably still now, I have an affection for the music, though I can see that it's not as developmentally interesting as Beethoven. It doesn't have the, I don't know what the right word is, imagination musically, but it's sincere, I think worthy music on its own terms.
I think it's quite beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why don't we hear it?
That's Murray Pariah. He has a new CD of Chopin Etudes. Terry Gross spoke with him last year. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Bantam Books, publisher of And Justice There Is None, a Kincaid and James detective novel by Deborah Crombie, author of A Finer End. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, in honor of the 50th anniversary of Singing in the Rain, we'll talk with Stanley Donen, who co-directed and choreographed the film. Also, we continue our conversation with pianist Murray Pariah, and movie critic David Edelstein reviews Igby Goes Down.
All I do is dream of you the whole night through. With the dawn, I still go on dreaming of you. You're every thought, you're everything, you're every song I ever sing. Summer, winter, autumn, and spring. And were there more than 24 hours a day, they'd be spent in sweet content dreaming away. Skies are gray.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with pianist Murray Pariah. He has a new CD of Chopin Etudes. His other recent recordings include Bach's Keyboard Concertos and Bach's Goldberg Variations. Pariah immersed himself in Bach when a hand injury prevented him from playing. Terry spoke with Pariah last year about his injury and about one of his mentors, Vladimir Horowitz.
Getting back to Horowitz, you were apparently the last person to hear him play. You were in his apartment the night before he died.
I was.
Do you remember what he was playing and what he was saying about it?
Oh, very, very clearly. He played for me a Liszt arrangement, I think, of a Bach chorale, Weinenklagen, Sorgensagen. And then we talked a lot about Mozart, who is a composer he loved, especially towards his last few years. And I just remember that he was calm and that there was a lot of wisdom, I felt, and that he had a turbulent few months right before that. I don't quite know why.
What do you mean when you say turbulent?
Well, erratic. He wanted to concertize suddenly again, but he wasn't practicing. He wanted very much to make this last recording, which he did. And I don't know, I felt it was turbulent, a little chaotic. Doing things at the last minute, organizing, for instance, a recital, and he hadn't really been working towards this recital, and it would have been about 2 weeks after he died. And suddenly there was a calm in him that I felt that night, and that everything had gone back to, well, the Horowitz that I knew. And so it seemed much more relaxed, and I was very, very relieved about it, and then suddenly he died.
When you became close to him during the last few years of his life, did hearing him play and hearing him talk about music affect you? Did it give you ideas or change your direction? You know, outside of playing more of the virtuoso.
Yes, it did. And I saw what a genuine musician he was, how motivated he was by the music. That this was not the showman that had been depicted, let's say, on films or what one heard, that this was really a man whose life was determined by music and who music mattered a lot to him. Everything in his life revolved around the music. And also he read a lot, too. He read a lot the letters of Mozart, the biographies, all the things around the music as well. He was a very knowledgeable musician. That was a side that the public didn't know.
Did you find it very reassuring, may or may not be the word I'm thinking of here, to know that someone like Horowitz could like live a long life and keep playing to the absolute very end?
It was quite amazing, actually. But, you know, there's only one Horowitz. So,
true, right.
Yeah, it's unique. The man's energy, and it's more than energy. The demons and the angels, he would say, inside him were something amazing to behold.
Were you able to see those demons and angels close up?
Yeah, I did.
What were some of the demons?
Well, they're harder to describe, but I think they're the things that pushed him in a way. And, for instance, I saw him once get very angry at a recording session when he couldn't get a certain passage and start speaking in Russian. I don't think he was saying nice things. Turbulent would be the best word I could say.
Do you feel that for you too? It's the demons as well as the angels that drive you?
Yeah, that's right. But for me, it's a different thing as well. One of the things that I most occupied with is understanding. I don't know whether that was the case for Horowitz. For me, to understand organically the music is the most important thing. Why is this note there, and why is it not another note? And this is something almost that doesn't have to do with performance. It has to do with more abstract thought. That, for some reason, really occupies me.
So you think Horowitz is more intuitive and you have a more intellectual, analytical approach?
Perhaps, yes.
Do you ever worry about memory loss and performance? And I don't mean like Alzheimer's disease. I just mean like in the normal course of things, as people get a little older, they remember a little less.
Yeah, I do a little bit, but it's not a huge problem for me. And I would also get back to this idea of the division between what's analytical and what is inspirational or intuitive. I don't make such a division myself. And I think it's a fine line. I think that all of music is intuitive at some level. There might be more armor in terms of intellectual thought, but still the choices are intuitive. They're based on some inner compulsion that you can't completely analyze.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Murray Pariah spoke with Terry Gross last year. Coming up, Singing in the Rain turns 50. This is Fresh Air. It's been 50 years since Gene Kelly first danced and sang in the rain. In honor of the anniversary, there's a new DVD edition of Singing in the Rain. Stanley Donen was the co-director and choreographer of the film. In a moment, Donen will tell us about filming this scene.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. With a happy refrain, just singing, singing in the rain. Dancing in the rain. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Gene Kelly gave Stanley Donen his big break. Kelly chose Donen to be his assistant in a Broadway production of Best Foot Forward. Soon after, when they were both in Hollywood, Kelly brought the 19-year-old Donen to Columbia Pictures to work on CoverGirl, the movie that made Kelly a star. Kelly and Donen went on to co-direct On the Town, It's Always Fair Weather, and Singing in the Rain. Donen directed Fred Astaire in Royal Wedding and Funny Face. Donen's other films include Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, The Pajama Game, Damn Yankees, Charade, Two for the Road, and Bedazzled. When Terry spoke with Stanley Donen in 1996, she asked him how he figured the rain and the puddles into the choreography of his most famous production number.
People believe these things happen spontaneously. Certainly dance numbers are anything but spontaneous. They're worked out in great detail over quite a long period of time. And so we decided where, how, what he would dance, how he would dance, how quickly he would dance, what the steps were, where he would be. We rehearsed on the street and so on, and we said, he'll splash in a puddle here. Well, there had to be a puddle there, so we had to chop out the cement and make a little hole, and then it would fill up with water, and he would splash in that puddle there. And since dance is very specific, and when you do it the same way every time, you end up in the same spot, we placed the puddles where they were necessary.
Now, where did the rain come from?
Pipes. It came from the Culver City water supply. Pipes overhead feeding the rain.
Did you make the temperature of the water warm so that Gene Kelly's muscles wouldn't be a problem?
No, yeah. On the contrary. It was so hot in there. It would have been nice if the water had been cool. We were in midsummer, and we were under black canvas, so in the bright daylight. We didn't shoot it at night in real night. And the sun beating down on a black canvas overhead with the water pouring down on it was like a sauna in there.
Hmm.
Would have been better to have refrigerated water in that case.
Now, you work with Gene Kelly. You also work with Fred Astaire on the films Royal Wedding and Funny Face. Now, did you have a different approach to shooting each of them since their approach to dance was different?
Yes.
Could you describe the difference in shooting them?
Well, because Gene's movements are basically athletic, and the force of the movement is important to get the thrill of watching him dance, it's harder to produce that on film because film is not able to get forceful movement because it's only a two-dimensional medium. And you need two eyes to see sharp, hard, forward and back or sideways movement. You need three dimensions. And therefore, I tried to make up for that lack in the way I photographed it, which meant trying to make it a more dynamic move by the placement or movement of the camera or lack of movement of the camera. With Fred, you want to get the delicacy of the movement. So it's another way of focusing the eye in this two-dimensional medium on his physical, you know, subtle movements.
There's a dance scene I want you to talk about that's very mysterious when you see it. It's the dancing on the ceiling sequence, the sequence that your biography is named after. This is a Fred Astaire dance number from Royal Wedding. Yeah, from Royal Wedding. So, he dances on the floor and the walls and the ceiling on this. What did you do to create that illusion?
We had to build a room inside a wheel or a barrel, if you like, which turned slowly and in which the camera turned with the room as well as the lights and everything in the room. And its turning had to be so controlled and gentle, both in timing and in movement, that the things didn't shake or didn't throw Fred Astaire around, and the camera had to be fixed to its position so it turned exactly as the room did, and so did the lights. Otherwise, you would see the room turning. As the lights stayed still, you'd see shadows moving and so on. And then the wall, if we were now going to Fred dancing from the floor to the side wall, slowly the side wall becomes the floor, and he's actually dancing on that floor, which is now the wall of the room. But since the camera turns with it, the camera doesn't know that the set has moved in that sense. It doesn't see outside the room, so to the camera, it's still the side wall, and it looks like Fred has actually gone to the side wall. And that's repeated on the ceiling, the other side, and so on.
So did the choreography have to be done in such a way as to coincide with the turning of the room?
Yes, and the turning of the room had to coincide with the choreography and so on. They had to marry each other. And that only could happen with trial and error.
You say in your biography that the most difficult part in a film musical is making that transition from talking into dancing or talking into singing. And I could see how that would be the most difficult the most difficult part. What are some of the ways you've gotten around that in production numbers to try to make a smooth transition?
Well, we try any number of ways. In the number we were just talking about, in All the World to Me is the name of the song where he dances around the room, you hear him singing, but actually his lips aren't moving in the beginning. So it's almost as though his singing is an underscoring of the scene. And then after the verse of the song, he starts theoretically singing it with his mouth. So that's one technique. There are numbers of ways I've tried to do it. I've tried it sometimes with the characters back to the camera. You hear him singing, but you don't see him singing. Sometimes in Singing in the Rain, we had a little vamp, which was written, which sort of eased him from dialogue into song. The vamp ahead of the song was written by Roger Edens. Most people are familiar with it. It goes do 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 do. That little vamp. He sings that, and that seems to bridge the moment.
And in Moses Supposes, they start talking about that.
In Moses Supposes, they're talking the lyric. That's right, and then the music joins the talk. So there are, I hope, endless ways of avoiding a catastrophe at that moment.
Yeah, well, what goes wrong if that transition isn't done just right? Do you think the audience thinks it looks
people
foolish?
People laugh is what goes wrong. They think this is highly unlikely. People don't sing in this situation, they think. Why are they doing that? It seems not real, not acceptable, and it makes the audience uncomfortable, and they laugh.
Now, when you worked at MGM, or at least I think most of the time you were at MGM, Louis B. Mayer was the head of the studio.
Not really.
Just part of the time?
Well, by the time we did Singing in the Rain, Dori Sherry was there running the studio. Mayer was still there, but the decisions were made by Dori Sherry.
Wow. What was Mayer like to work with?
I knew him very slightly. He was clearly... he had a large input into what kind of films were made. He was someone who, I think if he were alive today, he couldn't bear it. He would have lost his mind because he wanted films to only be sweet and gentle and talk about mothers loving sons and daughters and family things. He loved, for example, the Andy Hardy series, which showed the kind of family life, the only kind of family life he really liked to see. He didn't like to see, for example, women in slacks. It drove him mad. He thought it's not feminine for a woman to wear pants. I remember there was a great problem, as I was told, about Katharine Hepburn, who wore pants in some MGM movies. He didn't like that. He had a lot of things which found their way into the whole studio output. He didn't like shiny surfaces for some reason.
Shiny surfaces?
Film. Yes, he didn't like things reflecting. Uh-huh. So MGM films, unless you fought very hard, had a very soft look to them. He didn't like dark shadows, so MGM black and white films had filled in light in the shadow areas. There were all kinds of odd things.
Did you ever want to do something that was either bleaker or... where the lighting was darker or the mood sexier than Louis B. Mayer wanted?
Well, I think I can't think of a specific instance, but we always tried to make the lighting look... L.B. Mayer's idea of lighting was not, from my point of view, didn't have any dynamic quality to it. It was too bland. So we fought to do that, but... I can't give you an example of off the top of my head.
Now, what was the process of fighting like? Would you go into his office and, make your case?
No. It was all done through... He was way above all that. It was... These things had become law at the studio in a funny way, unwritten, albeit. But, there are all kinds of departments. The wardrobe department said, Mr. Mayer won't like this, so the camera department said, Mr. Mayer won't like this, or the set, the art department, Mr. Mayer won't like it like that. And you have to find a way to get around that, whatever that might be. Using the star power or your producer or being adamant yourself and saying, well, we're going to do it like this and I don't care what he likes. However you got around it. But his presence physically was not, he never confronted these issues with the people involved.
Stanley Donen co-directed and co-choreographed Singing in the Rain. A new 50th anniversary DVD edition of the film has just been released.
Make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My dad said be an actor, my son. But be a comical one, they'll be standing in lines for those old honky-tonk monkey shines. Or you could study Shakespeare and be quite elite, and you could charm the critics and have nothing to eat. Just slip on a banana peel, the world's at your feet. Make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh.
Coming up, a review of the new movie, Igby Goes Down. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Igby Goes Down is a new comedy about the emotionally messy life of an alienated teenager played by Kieran Culkin. Susan Sarandon stars as his mother. It's the debut film of writer and director Burr Steers. Film critic David Edelstein says it's a film not to be missed.
One of the worst things about going to American movies in the 1980s, before the rise of independent cinema, was that studios insisted on heroes who were likable. Studio heads would say, "I don't care about this guy. He's a jerk. We need to see him pet a dog." One mogul refused to greenlight the remake of The Fly because he didn't think an audience would accept a hero who was also a villain. His words. "I'm delighted that this era is over. And not only because I can relate more easily to jerks. It's that some heroes can demonstrate their vulnerability and even their essential goodness through anger. Jerks have to work a lot harder than nice guys. The biggest jerk in movies right now is the hero of Igby Goes Down. He's also the most vulnerable. He might even be the most likable, although maybe not if you actually met him and he called you an idiot. In the first scene of the movie, the teenage Igby, who's played by Kieran Culkin, watches stone-faced as his mother, played by Susan Sarandon, doesn't die from a dose of poison. Then he watches with equal impassiveness when his older brother, played by Ryan Phillippe, slips a plastic bag over her head. We don't yet know whether they've murdered her or assisted in some kind of suicide. But in either case, it's a scene of primal horror, a mystery to be penetrated in a movie that's a long, grueling flashback. Did I mention that Igby Goes Down as a comedy? It is, and not a flip black comedy in which loss has no sting, but a wrenching, tumultuous, emotionally chaotic comedy, a comedy in which grief is expressed in rage. The first-time writer-director, Burr Steers, has given us a teenage hero who knows only what he hates. He hates his rich and narcissistic mother. It gives him pleasure to frustrate her monumental will. He flunks out of school after school. He runs away and hides with Manhattan bohemians. He seems to blame her for the insanity of his absent dad, played by Bill Pullman, who shows up in his dreams like a wreck out of F. Scott Fitzgerald. He hates his unctuous preppy brother, an honor student at Columbia, who seems almost incestuously in league with his mother. He hates his vastly wealthy godfather, D.H., played by Jeff Goldblum, a cold snob who takes a strange interest in his upbringing. At a cocktail party at D.H.'s beach house in the Hamptons, Igby meets a young woman he might actually like, a cool misfit named Suki, played by Claire Danes. The actress is all grown up here and alluringly self-contained. It's promising, but the encounter is polluted by the arrival of Igby's brother.
"I'm Oliver, and this is my little brother, Igby."
"What kind of a name is Igby?"
"It's the kind of a name that someone named Suki is in no position to question."
"Suki? Suki, where do you go to school?"
"Bennington."
"Ollie's majoring in neo-fascism at Columbia."
"Economics."
"Semantics."
"What's your major?"
"Attitude."
"I've got to get back to the bar."
"That's where I'm headed."
"Oh. Catch your kids later."
There's a long line of movies about dysfunctional kids and their heartless mothers. The modern template is ordinary people. But unlike them, Igby Goes Down doesn't feel like the product of psychoanalysis. Its hero's despair hasn't been diagrammed, or his rebelliousness turned into a metaphor. The movie hasn't been designed to make his callow narcissism seem a state of grace, as it is in Wes Anderson's Rushmore, whatever that movie's charms. Igby's journey is haphazard and messy. The movie is built on one emotional dissonance after another. Kieran Culkin's face is a mask of sneering sophistication, but we can see that it's a mask. We can even glimpse on occasion the face of the lonely and frightened child underneath. Igby has grown up with people who don't know how to express their love, and so this smart mouth provokes them in lieu of asking for what he really needs. He gets hit, too. He gets slugged a couple of times by a therapist, which shocks him and us. He gets cuffed by a beautiful and damaged young artist played by Amanda Peet, at whose loft he's been hiding. He gets beaten up by his godfather, who finds out Igby's been sleeping with his mistress. And those are just the physical blows. The other ones, from his mom and his sometime girlfriend, draw even more blood. And still he goads them, needing only a response. The way this movie goads us, with its scenes that sometimes go on too long, its sudden cruelties, its great actors who hit unpleasant notes they've never hit on screen before. Igby Goes Down got a reaction from me. I squirmed. I laughed a lot. I thought about how cursed this boy was by his enraged sense of entitlement. And I thought I was watching the movie of the year.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Jazz pianist Dodo Marmarosa died earlier this month in his hometown of Pittsburgh. He was 76. Early in his career, Dodo Marmarosa played with Gene Krupa, Tommy Dorsey, and Artie Shaw. In the mid-40s, he played with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Soon after that, he dropped out of the music scene. Let's close with the Charlie Parker Septet, with Dodo Marmarosa on piano, recorded in 1946. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Aveda, maker of sustainably sourced hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Christopher Reeve. His 1995 horseback riding accident left him paralyzed, yet he's made remarkable breakthroughs in regaining feeling and motion in parts of his body. His new book is called Nothing is Impossible. Join us for the next Fresh Air.